I want you to imagine, just for a second, volunteering to stand right in the middle of a collapsing war zone.
Which, I mean, that goes against basically every human survival instinct, right?
Yeah, you aren't there to fight. You're armed with, like, little more than a bright blue helmet, a rifle you are barely legally permitted to use, and a piece of paper from New York called a mandate.
And meanwhile, right over your head, the world's most advanced militaries and these completely unpredictable non-state rebel groups are just actively exchanging heavy artillery fire.
Exactly. Yet that is the exact reality unfolding all over the globe right now. Welcome to This Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
Today we are unpacking an unprecedented and frankly perilous moment in global history. We're looking specifically at March 2026. We have a massive stack of sources today, from UN press briefings out of Geneva to global news reports from the AP in Burma.
Yeah, and some incredibly tense on-the-ground dispatches from the Middle East and Africa.
The mission of this deep dive is to understand a fundamental shift in global security. Like, we need to figure out what actually happens when the very people tasked with maintaining global peace, the people trying to deliver life-saving aid, suddenly become the targets.
And, you know, before we really get into the mechanics of these specific conflicts, we do need to establish a clear baseline for how we are analyzing all this information.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because the events we are breaking down today, especially the rapidly escalating military situations in the Middle East and the complex internal conflicts in South Sudan, they are highly politically charged.
Extremely.
So to be absolutely clear to you listening, our analysis here does not represent taking any sides. We are not endorsing any of the geopolitical viewpoints, military campaigns, or official statements contained in these source materials.
Right. Our sole objective is to impartially report and synthesize the tactical and geopolitical facts exactly as they've been presented to us.
Exactly. We are just here to understand the machinery of modern peacekeeping and why it is currently breaking down.
That is a crucial distinction, because the machinery is undeniably under massive strain right now. To understand how severe this is, we have to start with the most immediate crisis in the Middle East.
Right, in Lebanon.
Yeah, the threat to peacekeepers there is fiercely tactical. I mean, they are caught in a literal physical crossfire.
And the timeline of this specific escalation is vital here. On February 28th, a joint U.S.-Israeli military campaign against Iran commenced.
Okay.
Following Israel's killing of Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, Hezbollah immediately resumed heavy rocket attacks.
Wow.
And in response to those rocket attacks, Israeli forces have pushed their ground incursions up to 7 kilometers deep into Lebanese territory.
And sitting right in the middle of that 7-kilometer stretch is UNIFIL, the United Nations interim force in Lebanon.
Right in the thick of it.
They're absorbing immense collateral and sometimes direct fire. Like, the on-the-ground reports detail a Ghanaian peacekeeper base being hit by a missile, leaving 4 soldiers injured, 1 in critical condition.
Yeah, and a Nepal army shelter in Maiz al-Jabal was completely obliterated by Israeli airstrikes.
It's just wild. Plus, UNIFIL reports that peacekeepers are being fired upon by non-state armed groups as well.
Exactly. The situation has degraded to the point where these peacekeepers, whose strict mandate is to observe and maintain peace, are actually having to return fire in self-defense.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. It sounds like being a referee in a boxing match, where both fighters suddenly decide to start punching the ref instead.
That is, sadly, a very accurate analogy.
But here's my pushback. The briefings cite over 15,000 violations of the ceasefire resolution 1701.
Yeah, 15,000.
And over 800,000 Lebanese citizens have been displaced from their homes. Yet you have 7,500 UNIFIL troops, made up of soldiers from 48 different countries, just flat out refusing to leave.
Right. Their mandate runs until December 31st, 2026.
And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is physically in Beirut right now, launching a $308.3 million flash appeal. But if both sides have violated this resolution 15,000 times, and the peacekeepers are just trapped in bunkers taking missile fire, their military value seems effectively zero.
I get that.
What is the actual strategic point of them staying in that kill zone?
I know it seems completely counterintuitive until you look at what happens the second they actually leave.
Okay.
The UN has warned that without an objective presence, southern Lebanon could turn into a, quote, barren land. Right now, those 7,500 peacekeepers are the absolute only independent monitors left on the ground.
And in the fog of war, objective truth is always the first casualty.
Precisely. UNIFIL is the mechanism recording those 15,000 violations. They are the ones documenting the airspace incursions and the artillery fire for the international record.
Oh, I see. So what you're saying is that their actual value right now isn't military at all. It's psychological and logistical. They are basically acting as human tripwires.
That's exactly it. And beyond the international reporting, their physical presence is the only thing keeping a highly fragile humanitarian corridor open.
Ah, for the aid agencies.
Right. If UNIFIL pulls out, the agency is delivering food, water, and medical supplies to those 800,000 displaced people, lose all logistical and physical cover.
So the peacekeepers aren't there to win a firefight. They are just the physical pillars holding up a collapsing ceiling so civilians have a chance to escape.
Exactly. If they leave, the agencies leave, and the civilian death toll becomes unimaginable.
That makes complete sense. So in Lebanon, the threat is this tactical crossfire. But moving from the Middle East to Africa, the nature of the threat against the UN completely transforms.
It really does.
In South Sudan, the threat isn't just tactical. It is existential to the UN's authority itself. They aren't just taking stray bullets. They are being legally and intentionally ordered off the map by the host government.
Yeah, South Sudan represents a fundamental challenge to the foundational rules of the United Nations. In the town of Akobo, the state military, the SSPDF, issued a hard 72-hour ultimatum.
Just a total eviction notice.
Right. They ordered UN peacekeepers, all humanitarian groups, and all civilians to completely vacate the town.
Because the SSPDF was prepping a massive military offensive against the opposition forces, the SPLA-IO.
Yes. And the UN's response was highly unusual here. They openly defied a direct military order from a sovereign host nation.
Which is a huge deal. The mission chief, Anita Kiki Gebeho, stated the UN would absolutely not leave and would maintain a, quote, protective presence for the civilians in Akobo.
Yeah. But while that phrase protective presence projects strength, the reality on the ground in Akobo is devastating. Doctors Without Borders was actually forced to evacuate under the pressure.
And what happened after they left is just unimaginable. Following their evacuation, their hospital was looted, the office was ransacked, and 84 wounded patients were left behind with absolutely no medicine.
No basic nursing equipment either. Meanwhile, the remaining civilians are just fleeing toward the Ethiopian border.
And the geopolitical reaction has been severe. The Troika even sent a formal letter to President Salva Kiir protesting this evacuation order.
The involvement of the Troika, which is the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway, that's a massive diplomatic signal.
Right, because they aren't just three random countries writing a strongly worded letter.
Exactly. The Troika were the historical architects who helped midwife South Sudan's independence. So when they issue a formal protest to President Kiir, it carries immense geopolitical weight.
It signals that the international community is watching a sovereign state intentionally dismantle its own civilian protections. It's honestly like a landlord trying to illegally evict the fire department right before they intentionally burn the building down.
That's a really good way to frame it.
But wait, let's look at the mechanics of this standoff for a second. Doesn't the UN legally require the host country's consent to operate within its borders?
They do, yes.
So how does a UN mission actually possess the legal authority to just say no to a sovereign nation's military?
You are hitting on the central defining tension of modern international law right there. UN peacekeeping missions operate on the foundational principle of host nation consent. You cannot just invade a sovereign country with a blue-helmeted army.
Right, obviously.
However, these missions are authorized by the UN Security Council with highly specific mandates. In the case of South Sudan, that mandate explicitly prioritizes the protection of civilians who are under imminent threat of physical violence.
Ah, so the mandate to prevent a massacre basically overrides the host government's eviction notice.
Exactly, and it creates a massive diplomatic and tactical paradox. The host government claims state sovereignty, the absolute right to conduct military operations within its own borders.
But the UN stance is that state sovereignty does not grant a government the right to create a humanitarian catastrophe or slaughter its own people.
Precisely. When Chief Gebeho draws that line in the sand, it is a staggering display of nerve. Remember, the humanitarians are gone, the medical supplies are looted.
It's just a contingent of peacekeepers standing between an advancing state army and 84 wounded patients who couldn't run to Ethiopia. It completely redefines what we think of when we hear the word peacekeeper.
It really does.
They aren't keeping a peace, they're defying a war. So we have the tactical crossfire in Lebanon and the sovereign legal standoff in South Sudan.
Right.
But the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, introduces a threat that feels like it belongs in a different century altogether. If South Sudan is a traditional boots-on-the-ground standoff, the DRC is defined by asymmetric, faceless drone warfare.
The DRC really illustrates how rapidly the technology of war is outpacing the diplomacy of peace. We are looking at an incident in the city of Goma where a drone strike hit right near the home of former President Joseph Kabila.
And tragically, this strike killed a French UNICEF aid worker named Karine Bousset.
Right. And the M23 rebel group, which controls massive swaths of territory in the region, immediately blamed the government for the strike,
while denying responsibility themselves. And all of this is happening against the backdrop of a conflict that has displaced an unbelievable 7 million people.
7 million. It's hard to even comprehend.
What strikes me as wild is that the UN is bringing back James Swan to head up the mission there, MONUSCO. He's returning exactly 10 years after he last left the country.
It must be a surreal homecoming for him.
Just imagine leaving an incredibly messy room, coming back a decade later, and the conversation is still dominated by the exact same people, Kabila and the M23 rebels. But now, instead of just ground skirmishes, there are flying robots dropping explosives on residential compounds.
Yeah, the players remain the same, but the geometry of the battlefield has entirely changed.
Right. Imagine you're a peacekeeper who has been trained for the last 20 years to establish a secure perimeter. You lay down sandbags, you set up a checkpoint, you look through binoculars for trip movements.
Very traditional ground doctrine.
Exactly. Your entire doctrine of safety is based on a two-dimensional map. Suddenly, the threat isn't on the horizon. It's a cheap, commercial drone hovering 500 feet above your bunk.
Yeah.
How do traditional blue helmets even begin to protect themselves or civilians against high-tech aerial warfare operated by rebel groups?
Well, they're being forced to completely rewrite the playbook in real time. Traditional peacekeeping relies heavily on visual identification and physical barriers. But a drone doesn't care about a concrete barricade.
No, not at all.
To defend against this, missions have to shift away from just sandbags and rifles. They have to start implementing signal jamming, electronic warfare capabilities, and acoustic sensors to detect incoming drones before they drop a payload.
Which requires an entirely different level of funding and technical expertise than just handing a soldier a blue helmet and a rifle.
Exactly. And the implications go far beyond just the defense budget. International humanitarian law fundamentally relies on accountability, knowing exactly who pulled the trigger so you can prosecute war crimes. But remote-controlled weapons, especially when used by non-state actors like M23, entirely bypass those traditional frameworks. It's the pinnacle of asymmetric warfare.
Because a small, relatively underfunded rebel group can just acquire off-the-shelf drone technology and suddenly project localized air power.
Yes. They can strike a residential neighborhood and simply deny they were the ones flying it. The UN was built to monitor state militaries. It was not built to defend against faceless aerial assassinations.
That is a chilling realization. The entire concept of accountability just vanishes into the cloud. And speaking of the massive resources required to adapt to these new threats, we have to look at the global economic toll.
It's staggering.
Because the ripple effects of a drone strike in Goma, or a standoff in Akobo, or missiles in Lebanon, are severely straining the entire global logistical network.
Right. The financial disparity highlighted by UN Relief Chief Tom Fletcher is just grim. He pointed out that the current conflict in the Middle East is estimated to be costing $1 billion a day.
$1 billion a day.
Meanwhile, the UN's comprehensive global plan to help 87 million vulnerable people worldwide is currently $14 billion underfunded.
It's like the global community is intentionally spending $1 billion a day to flood the house and then arguing over whether they can afford a $14 mop to clean it up.
That's exactly what it's like.
The math of human suffering is completely inverted.
And the economic impact isn't just about the direct cost of munitions either. The conflict in the Middle East is severely disrupting commercial shipping through the Strait of Hormuz.
Which affects basically everything.
Right. Fletcher warned that this instability directly threatens to drive up the cost of food, medicines, and life-saving aid globally. When supply routes choke, the cost of a bag of grain in a refugee camp in Africa skyrockets.
And human beings get caught in that logistical chokehold. The reports detail how migrant workers in Lebanon and Iran are utterly stranded right now.
Yes, and the International Organization for Migration, the IOM, is desperately struggling to find the resources to evacuate them.
But the funds simply aren't there because the money is being vaporized in the conflict zones.
Hmm.
But amidst all this heavy systemic breakdown, there's a fascinating development in how peacekeeping forces are actually evolving their personnel to meet these new challenges?
Yes. Looking at the African Union Support and Stabilization Mission in Somalia, or AUSM at CHUM.
Right. On International Women's Day, female troops, specifically contingents from Uganda and Kenya, were highly commended for their roles on the ground.
Which is a huge operational shift.
But it's easy to see press releases like that from international bodies and assume it's just, you know, good public relations for the UN and the African Union.
Sure.
Looking at the brutal realities we've just discussed, drones, state armies, proxy militias, how does the push for female peacekeepers actually change the tactical reality on the ground in a place like Somalia?
Oh, it provides a massive, tangible operational advantage. If you want to understand the tactical value, you have to look at who is actually suffering the most in these conflict zones. The most vulnerable populations are almost always women and children. Take a look back at the data from Lebanon. The UNFPA reported that there are currently 11,600 pregnant women affected by the crisis.
Wow. Many of whom were displaced with health facilities shutting down around them.
Yeah.
So you have women being forced into incredibly vulnerable, dangerous medical situations just to give birth, surrounded by armed combatants.
Precisely. Now, place that reality into a highly conservative society or a region traumatized by systemic gender-based violence.
Right.
Civilian women in those environments are often terrified to speak with, trust, or seek protective help from male soldiers, regardless of what flag is on their uniform. A male peacekeeper, no matter how well-intentioned or highly trained, often represents the very demographic that has been terrorizing them.
Ah, I see. So female troops can physically and culturally access spaces and populations that male troops are completely locked out of.
Exactly. Female peacekeepers drastically enhance the intelligence-gathering capabilities of a mission. Civilian women are far more likely to report troop movements, hidden weapons caches, or community tensions to a female soldier.
So they improve conflict resolution at the granular community level.
Mm-hmm.
It is not about optics at all. Having female peacekeepers is a critical tactical requirement to establish trust and actually execute the mandate of civilian protection.
It really is.
That entirely reframes the concept of force strength. It isn't just about how much firepower a unit has. It's about how deeply they can integrate into the community they're trying to save.
Absolutely.
Okay, as we wrap up this deep dive, let's bring all of this directly to you, the listener. You might be listening to this on your commute or while working, wondering why you should be invested in the logistics of a standoff in Akobo or a drone strike in Goma.
Yeah. Why does the machinery of the UN matter to your daily life?
It matters because what we are witnessing in March 2026 is the ultimate stress test of the global safety net.
Well, yeah.
Yes, the shipping disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz are going to inflate the cost of goods at your local store.
For sure.
But more profoundly, these peacekeepers, the ones taking fire in bunkers in Lebanon, the ones staring down state armies in South Sudan, the ones trying to outsmart drones in the DRC, they represent the incredibly fragile, thin blue line between global order and total humanitarian collapse.
And witnessing that line bend under so much pressure leaves us with a critical foundational question to consider. Traditional peacekeeping was built on 20th century architecture. Treaties between recognized nation states clearly defined physical borders and the explicit consent of governments.
Right.
But warfare has irrevocably mutated. We are entering an era dominated by proxy groups, non-state actors, and remote-controlled drone strikes that recognize absolutely no borders.
And claim no accountability.
Exactly. So, as the very nature of war fundamentally transforms around them, is the traditional concept of the peacekeeper becoming completely obsolete? Or, as the global order fractures, are they about to become more vital and, unfortunately, more vulnerable than ever before?
That is a profound and terrifying thought to leave on. The next time you see an image of that bright blue helmet on the news, remember the impossible complexity of what they're actually standing in the middle of.
Mm.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.